Hi and welcome to Matrix Moments. This is Saloni and in today's episode, we aim to uncover the learnings from serial entrepreneur Bhavin Turakhia. Bhavin is currently founder and CEO at Flock, co-founder and CEO at Zeta, and founder of Radix Registry. He started out at the age of 17 when he co-founded his first tech venture, DirectEye, with his brother Divyang Turakhia. DirectEye owned brands like Big Rock, Logic Boxes, Reseller Club, and webhosting.info. In 2014, he exited and sold all four companies to Endurance Group, a NASDAQ-listed web hosting firm, in a $160 million transaction. His neo-banking venture, Zeta, recently raised its first round of investment and was valued at $300 million. Over the last 21 years, he has built five successful businesses, all driven by his passion for problem-solving and maximizing efficiency through tech-driven innovations. This episode is part one of a two-part episode and will be moderated by Tarun Davda, Managing Director at Matrix Partners India, who incidentally also happened to work with Bhavin as General Manager and Business Head at Big Rock close to a decade ago.
Hi everyone, welcome to Matrix Moments. We have a very special guest with us today. This is someone I'm personally very fond of and have had the opportunity to work with in my past, Bhavin Turakhia, who was the founder and CEO of DirectEye and is now founder and CEO of Flock and Zeta. Bhavin, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tarun. Yeah, awesome to be on it.
So, Bhavin, you've had actually a very, very unique journey as far as entrepreneurs in India are concerned. And I'm really excited to have you on the show because a lot of the things that, I've seen you personally and have observed you have been fairly unique. And, your thought process, how you built your companies, has been very different from what, we see a lot of sort of VC-funded entrepreneurs building. So I thought, this would be a great, experience for founders listening in to see how a bootstrap entrepreneur has been able to scale a company to very large sort of levels. So maybe first question, just overall, I think, walk us through a little bit of a highlight reel of your journey from co-founding DirectEye in 1998 with Divyang, all the way to your most recent ventures, which is, Flock and Zeta. So, and, you can talk about just about, how did the idea of DirectEye come about? Was it an accident? Was it, deliberate? Did you pick web hosting and domain registration as a space to, just more as, hey, I see this is where sort of the internet is going, or was it more an accident, number one? And number two, talk a little bit about, I guess, your early childhood days, right? And what are the key experiences that shaped you?
Awesome. Thanks, Tarun. Yeah. And, to start with, as you said, I've had the opportunity and the luxury to take a slightly different path in comparison to conventional entrepreneurship. In terms of at least the first company that I co-founded, I didn't actually raise any funds. And in fact, with Flock and Zeta and with Radix, I funded the initial stages myself. We recently raised a Series C for Zeta, but this is kind of my first ever fundraise. And I think in many ways, it only goes to establish. I don't think there's one secret formula for success or one definitive path. It only goes to sort of prove or evidence that there actually are no constraints. Sometimes people will think of funding as a constraint. Sometimes people will think of, ideas as a constraint. And I think and believe, I've always believed that you can achieve anything you set your mind to. And that's kind of a good segue into part B of your question, which is talking about my early childhood days and some key experiences that shaped me. I think in many ways, for both myself and Div, I think we're very grateful for the kind of childhood that we've had. We're very privileged to have had the parents that we've had and the upbringing that we've had. A lot of the credit for where I am today in terms of, my principles, values, and the person that I am goes to my parents, goes to my father, who sort of spent a lot of his time and invested really behind our education. So he used to always keep repeating to both of us constantly this sort of mantra that I spoke about, which is you can achieve anything you set your mind to. And sometimes something so fundamentally simple becomes so powerful. I've had the opportunity to start companies in four or five different industries and spaces, each of which I knew nothing about before I started out. I had no formal education, whether it's in payments or enterprise communication or web hosting or whatever it is. And each time I along with my co-founders or whatever, we picked up that particular space, approached it from first principles, learned everything that we could or needed to about that space, and then really built an amazing business or are building amazing businesses around them. And just the courage and the mental resilience and the sort of attitude of being able to do so is it comes and it's sort of derived from that sort of single powerful statement that I've always believed that that I can achieve anything I set my mind to. Dad also spent we came from a sort of a humble beginnings. Dad sort of moved to Mumbai sort of before I was born and set up his sort of chartered accountancy practice. We were living in one small sort of single room with his elder brother and then moved to his own sort of the house that he purchased and went through schooling, et cetera, in Mumbai. Mm. And throughout throughout my childhood, I remember he would compromise on several luxuries for himself, but he spent such a lot of money on buying books for us. We had tons and tons of books about pretty much every subject. And throughout my schooling, I remember we used to have a standard curriculum where we would have various, subjects, etc. Math, science, physics, and things like that. And we'd have a standard curriculum prescribed by the school. But then over and above that, my dad would go out and buy like five other books by different authors on, each of these subjects. And I would kind of devour all of them to get a much more holistic overview. So right in the beginning, from an early childhood, really instilled this habit of reading a lot, which I carry even until today. I read about 2 to 3 books every month.
Wow.
And that's been all throughout the journey. I found my passion early on. So I was in this school called Arya Vidya Mandir in Bandra. Both me and my brother.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
They installed their very first computer room in 1989 when I was 10 years old. This was in sixth grade. And I was just hooked. Dad bought me sort of 35, 40 different books on programming. And I would spend all my time, like short breaks, lunch breaks. The computer teacher would leave the keys to sort of computer room with me every day after school. So we couldn't afford a computer back at home.
Yeah.
And so she would leave the keys to the computer room and I would spend 2 to 3 hours every day after school practicing different sort of writing different software programs. One of the things that we had to do, I remember, was in school, we had to build out these computer projects twice a year. It was part of the ICSE curriculum. Mm-hmm. And most people would spend a couple of days building out some tiny applications. I spent 6 months on my project building out this really comprehensive game concerning sort of business and the stock markets. And it had like background music and graphics and lots of interesting stages. I really spent almost all my time on just computer science in many ways. It also helped that it was a boys-only school, so no other distractions.
No other distractions.
Overall, I was fortunate to find my passion early on. Right then, I knew that whatever I did in life, had to be around computer science in some form. This was the days when computers were like, I was doing programming in BASIC, C++, GW BASIC, etc. Computers were like these MS-DOS, green monochrome terminals. There was no Windows, there was no internet. There were no hard disks. We had these 5 1/4 inch and 3 1/2 inch floppy drives. So, very, very different days from today. And then during the same time also, I think part of this is also because of my reading. I also spent a lot of time reading biographies. I remember reading, my favorite biographies then were about Microsoft. I read about 8 of them. Some of the best ones was about Microsoft. I read a bunch about on Apple, IBM, Xerox, but then even kind of non-tech companies like Chrysler Corp, McDonald's. And so again, during that phase, I devoured probably 30 to 40 different biographies. And
sorry to interrupt. One question I had, and as a parent, what you're saying is really intriguing, right? So one is, you telling your dad buying books for you, your dad telling you that, inspiring you by saying that, you can do pretty much anything that you set your mind on. As a parent, I've done that, right? But either my son will roll his eyes when I say these things or when I give, these books, eventually, and I don't know if it's just today, but it's just hard to get, kids to sit down and read something, right? There's so many distractions with gadgets and devices and mobile phones. And so a lot of it was it just innate curiosity that you just enjoyed reading books?
Firstly, I can tell you, I rolled my eyes enough number of times on my dad.
Okay,
and I'm not even kidding.
Now you sound more normal.
Sometimes I would be like, dad, we know, like you keep telling us this. But the thing is, I read this interesting quote, right? Repetition doesn't spoil the prayer. And that's really, I think, what applies out here. I mean, in hindsight, when I think about it, that constant repetition, even if you roll your eyes, it sinks in.
At some point.
It becomes your default truth.
I guess at some point you understand the meaning behind that statement.
You might just carry it as a notional statement that's being repeated, but after some time you really truly realize the power of the statement. And I think about books, I mean, I must say I'm not a parent, and I certainly have no experience in raising kids in this day and age with, as you said, all these sort of gadgets, etc. But I do think one thing is that kids are, and human beings are, innately curious. I don't think it takes a lot to fire up that curiosity. You have to channel it in the right direction. As I said, I can't claim to be an expert on parenting, but I don't think dad had to force us in any form because, you know, I was innately curious. And when I talk about reading biographies, I mean, they're like fun, inspiring stories. They actually, you know, they actually do end up releasing all the right hormones for anybody who reads them. So, so it's not too different. It's not like I didn't read my fair share of fiction. I pretty much completed, you know, as a kid, the entire Enid Blyton and all these sort of, you know, Hardy Boys and Three, you know, Investigators and all the kind of, you know, fiction stuff also. But parallelly, I love reading some of this stuff. And I always had an innate passion for math and physics. And so computer science kind of naturally rolls off of that. When you write a program and you see it work, I think all of this is biological. You start out with a goal, you punch in a set of instructions, you see something work, it's going to release all sorts of sort of positive hormones like dopamine, et cetera. And so I don't think you need to, you know, it's almost like, yeah, you can lead a horse to the water, you can't make him drink it. But then the rest of it is, many of us are innately curious. And these days I would even go so far as to say that there are so many online resources. I mean, take coding, for instance. You know, I learned it through books. So my dad bought tons of books, and I would literally go page by page by page, just trying everything out every day after school. But these days you have all these online apps and websites that actually gamify learning and make it so much more. I mean, they use behavioral psychology to actually get people addicted to coding and programming. So I think these days the variety of tools, I think as a parent, you just have the investigate and find the right tools. But I think there's tons of material available.
All the distractions that are there, there's also ways to get you more addicted to these things.
Exactly. Absolutely.
So coming to the second part, Direct Tie, like you've told me a little bit about your story of your early days and how you used to go, you know, holding servers around Bombay. But, you know, walk us through a little bit about that experience. You know, when did you decide eventually that you're going to start up? How did you decide that, you know, hosting and domains is the space you're going to pick?
Yeah, absolutely. So the internet came into the country around 94 with VSNL as the sole ISP, if you remember, for many, many years.
Yeah.
And they had these, you know, TCP, IP and shell internet accounts. And I got on the internet and I was really, again, fascinated by the concept of being able to transmit data across the world at pretty much zero cost. And so I realized, well, I mean, I always wanted to do something in computer science. I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. You know, funnily enough, there's never a scenario of me wanting to take a job. It's never been even an option or a possibility in my head. And so when the internet came in, I realized, well, this is it. This, it, you know, not only do I want to do something in tech, it has to leverage the internet because it's going to change the world. Like I could start thinking about possibilities of disintermediation and how this is going to dramatically change the landscape. I started writing code and building software and creating and kind of doing some consulting for people, building basic websites and things of that. And then I started out by building what was, you know, a disaster in terms of success. I built this entire sort of equivalent of a job site in early 96. Basically had this logic of creating this algorithm that would match vacancies with candidates and essentially automate the entire job hunting process, kind of like what, you know, LinkedIn or
Naukri. This was in 1996, huh?
And many of these guys have obviously sort of been very successful at it. I spent a lot of time building the product and going out there in the market, selling it for all, you know, trying to sell it for almost a year and a half. Whilst I didn't make much in terms of sales, the product was way ahead of its time. I actually overbuilt and over-engineered a product which really wouldn't function very well until the internet penetration in the country was substantially higher than what it was. I presumed that this product, and in fact, in my head, I was so convinced, I'm like, this is going to change the entire world. But practically, it would have never been feasible just because the fact that there were less than, you know, 50,000, 100,000 regular users of the internet in the first place.
Correct.
And, you know, whilst, you know, I met, I was like, 16, 17 back then. And whilst I went, I spoke to HR heads of many big, big companies. I spoke to placement agencies and consultants and did tons of like marketing and sales all on my own. And whilst I didn't make much in terms of sales, what ended up happening was a lot of these people were welcoming and would spend like an hour, hour and a half with me and you know, answer all my questions and open up their internal sort of processes and systems to me. And so it was an interesting learning experience. But eventually, at some point, when I really sat down to think about the practicality, I realized this product's not going to really work. And that's
build
why...
Build it and they will come doesn't work.
No. And that's been one of my fundamental mistakes multiple times over in life, by the way. And I've learned a lot from realizing the go-to-market is as or more important in many cases. And, you know, this sort of whole notion of building an MVP and lessons around that. But then, yeah, Dev and I then started with what we... thought, you know, I started off with this notion of the most fundamental product that anybody would need on the internet is if they want to set up their web presence, they're going to need hosting space, they're going to need, you know, domain name, they're going to need, you know, email. There were a couple of my friends who were running hosting companies, small ones in India. And so I basically bought my first server. Our dad lent us 25,000 rupees approximately to pay for the first quarter for a server in a company called Alabanza, which had a control panel that allowed me to break up that server into kind of smaller hosting packages and sell them to various companies. And this time around, you know, I flipped it around. So I remember, in fact, just 3 months after starting it, there was this huge conference. NASSCOM used to hold these, if you remember, again, back in the day, this big internet tech conference in Delhi.
Yeah.
And I didn't have the money to participate and you know, set up a booth there. But I instead sort of went, I took a train journey, went to Delhi. And I spent those 3 days going from booth to booth. And instead of kind of listening to their pitch, I actually sold them hosting packages and domain names. So if you set up a website or become a reseller. And that one conference was, you know, represented more sales in those 3 days than the 3 months before. Like it turned us into a mildly profitable company. I remember, I think we made 5 lakh rupees in profit or something like that in the first year by that March end. And then since then, we... you know, kept accelerating it and growing it.
I love the idea of going to a conference and actually selling to the booths that are trying to sell over there.
it was quite hilarious, but very successful. You know, I spent zero money in terms of exhibiting, but I ended up walking out with clients worth lakhs of rupees.
Wow.
So yeah, quite interesting as a process and journey. And then yeah, we kind of continued to grow the business. Became the first ICANN accredited domain registrar in India, started selling domain names through resellers and set up reseller network around the world, about, you know, 50,000 plus resellers the time we exited the business. So continue to grow that until about 2005, 2006. I think Div kind of then started working on Skenzo, which was sort of the domain advertising piece of the business, which eventually morphed into media.net. You know, somewhere in the middle, you joined in actually and started working with us on, you know, BigRock. And by then we had kind of defined businesses, BigRock, Pizza Club and Logic Boxes. And then I was reasonably hands-off actually by the time, you know, 2010, 2011, I was spending part of my time on the hosting business and DirectEye. And then I started working on Radix, which was my next company. In 2012, I started Radix with a small team, and we bought a bunch of sort of top-level extensions. We currently operate .online, .store, .tech, .website, .space, and many others. And then in 2014, I started Flock, which kind of morphed or pivoted from a sort of a messenger business that I was playing around with. And in 2015, I co-founded Zeta with Ramki. Ramki was working with us for a while before as my CTO in one of my companies, he's tech lead in one of my companies. And then the two of us started Zeta in 2015 because we're both passionate about the payment space.
So, you know, what I find really interesting about this, Bhavan, is, you know, you started with, and this is, you know, something I think which is interesting for a lot of people is, it started with a very simple idea, right? Which is, let me take, you know, X amount of hosting space, break it up into small pieces, and I'm going to try and sell it to, you know, people for a profit. And then you, over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, what you did is basically just expanded your sort of scope to everything from new GTLDs to, you know, resellers to direct to customer to accreditation to just a bunch of different things, which honestly I think is something that, you know, today everyone starts with this very really large vision, right? And then they find very quickly that, listen, actually realizing that vision is massively difficult. What I find interesting about what you've done is you've picked a small niche, tried to, you know, sort of focus on that and built a profitable company in that domain. And then over time, actually expanded your vision to including, you know, areas which are sort of adjacencies in the domain that you chose to operate.
No, absolutely. I think one of the biggest concerns that most early startups face is lack of focus. Yeah. If you sort of, you know, if you diversify too early on or start out, okay, that doesn't mean you shouldn't have big ambitions, right? Yeah. When I started, right. You know, when we started our hosting company, funnily enough, we would always be like, oh yeah, we're going to get millions of customers and we're going to have thousands of employees and we're going to have a global presence. And so a lot of our thinking in terms of how we shaped our culture or how we shaped our, you know, automation tools and processes or the things that we built were built with that global ambition in mind. So there's nothing wrong. In fact, if anything, I think it's important for entrepreneurs to have a healthy dose of delusion and a high sort of ambition. But focus is really, really important.
No, I agree. It's like the saying goes, right? More startups die out of indigestion than starvation, right? So great. So, you know, that actually takes me to my second question, which in some ways is related to what we just spoke about. So, you know, one thing I've found really fascinating about areas that you go in, whether it's, you know, it's Zeta, whether it's DirectEye, whether it's some of the other things that you've built, you've managed to select businesses that don't generally attract a lot of irrational competition, right? These are sort of areas that one can build profitable companies at scale that don't require sort of, you know, truckloads of capital. How much of this is intentional? How much of this is just, you know, your own liking towards these kind of, you know, businesses? Is there a science to how you pick opportunities?
Sure. So, I mean, I think there's a couple of different avenues through which some of the businesses have come about. And, you know, I spoke about DirectEye. I can talk about Radix, Flock, and Zeta. And in many ways, they kind of encompass or cover both the science and the art of how I went about picking some of these opportunities. I think it's a combination of things. You know, firstly, I think sometimes, you know, frustration is a genesis of entrepreneurship. So you see something in the industry and space and you're like, hey, why is nobody fixing this problem? Mm. And then you're like, well, I'm passionate about this and I'm going to pick up this problem. So this whole notion of being passionate about a space is critically important, I think, as an entrepreneur. The second aspect, and even more so now as I scale my newer companies, is a sort of much more deeper and scientific analysis on the size and scale of the space. And sometimes you chance upon it, sometimes it's opportunistic, and sometimes you really spend a lot of time digging deep and figuring out whether this makes sense or not. And I can talk about each of these three businesses and highlight specific aspects about them that cover these, as you know, cover these sort of principles. So with Radix, mm-hmm. It was very opportunistic. Div and me had been in the sort of hold domain names and hosting space for many, many years. By around 2009-2010, Div was already full-time running media.net. I had senior management that was running much of the kind of DirectEye sort of hosting and domains business. And I always believed this notion of like, why is it that the entire world only has these few top-level domains? Like, why is it, you know, it's only .com, .net, .org? I mean, imagine a world where everybody had only three options of last names.
Yeah.
Now we call it bizarre, like if you think about naming.
Correct.
the Internet Corporation of Assigned Names and Numbers, which ICANN, had already started thinking about a process of how to expand that. And mm-hmm. I really saw that as a huge opportunity and spent a significant amount of time between 2010 and 2012, like almost 20-25% of my time working with a small team of people in my company, really researching everything about this. So there was this opportunity that I knew was impending. I spent a lot of time doing research, and I think that's what resulted in the success. I want to point that piece out. Like Radix today, one out of every three or four new gTLD domains that are registered is a Radix TLD. So even though we have only 9 top-level extensions versus there being 1,000 plus out there, our 9 command about 25 to 33% of the market share. And the reason for that was the 2 years of prep work that went behind choosing every extension that we pursued and pricing those extensions in terms of how much I should be willing to pay for them. in the auction. So that's where the kind of research part and preparation part came in after identifying the opportunity. And Nadex is now a profitable, healthy business. Sandeep Ramchandani, who's the CEO now since the last few years, is the show and is doing an amazing job growing it. With Flock, it was kind of a pivot. I was interested in messaging in general. Started off with a few people from my tech team, etc., building out a personal messaging product. And then eventually, I spotted the opportunity subsequently. So it didn't start out with the opportunity. I have a personal penchant for productivity. I'm a huge, huge stickler for trying to get every single minute to be as efficient as possible. And over time, whilst the personal messaging space, I realized wasn't something that I would be able to sort of create a niche, or at least it didn't work out. I realized that what we've built and one of the areas that I'm passionate about is the highest wastage, I think, that occurs in any organization is about communication and collaboration. And I felt like I should focus on building something that will substantially improve efficiency in organization through much better collaboration. So that's how Flock was born, through a pivot. And we now have messaging, video calling, email, contacts, calendar, and a collaboration suite that substantially improves internal communication as well as external communication for organizations.
Mm.
And with Zeta, it was kind of a slightly different situation, which is it started from the size and, let's say, some sense of frustration. Ramki and I started talking for almost a year before we founded Zeta. We were both passionate about payments. We both felt like, I mean, why does cash still exist? The fact that it exists is an anomaly. Why is it that there is, digital transactions are not as great as sort of offline cash-based transactions, and have we to substitute them? Why is it that payments are such a frustration? If you look at enterprise sector, especially, forget the end-user sector, any organization in the world, whether you look at B2E, which is business-to-employee payments, such as salary disbursement, reimbursements, or allowances, or benefits, or expense management, or B2B payments, company to company, GST, etc. Every single accounts person, finance person, HR person, employee is frustrated with payment processes. Mm. They hate them. And so we're like, why is it that in this digital day and age, is there so much frustration and so much paperwork and delays and costs surrounding payments? And we spent a year, we said there's something here clearly. It's big. So that's now the kind of science and art behind spotting an opportunity, both with Flock and Zeta. The productivity space is huge.
Yeah.
And payment space is huge. And so it's a big space. We spent a year researching pretty much everything about the space. We read up regulations in different places, looked at exploring sort of starting up our own bank, looked at exploring different, B2C and B2B models, etc. And at the end, looked at technology stacks that existed, all the legacy products that exist in the system, etc. And then eventually, over the course of a year, formed a really ambitious, by the way, by far, one of my most ambitious plans to date, jointly figured out what's the kind of platform we want to build. And our goal and objective, our vision with Zeta is to sort of accelerate a world to invisible payments, where we feel payments should be completely invisible. And it's really the value that we can add on top of payments in various processes that we want to meaningfully exploit. And so we then decided specifically what product and service we want to start with, but also over the sort of course of the last 4 or 5 years, have evolved the vision in terms of how do we encompass this entire space that we anticipate, will be 20, 30 times bigger than anything I've created so far. So it's kind of a combination of opportunity, personal passion, which existed in both productivity and payments, and a significant amount of research and deep dive in both Radix and Zeta's case, actually almost a year and a half of research before I even started.
Yeah.
And the Flock sort of a pivot that happened because of some research afterwards.
Hmm. And have you just one sort of follow-up question on that? Do you consciously stay away from businesses that require very heavy capital burn?
So that's a good question. And I've thought about this myself, whether some of my choices have been conscious choices or it turns out that way. And I would say, I think it's a combination of both. I strongly believe that in almost any business, but this doesn't apply to all businesses, especially because the way the market operates today. But in most businesses, if you have limited cash, you can still figure out a way to acquire significant market share, but you have to think very, very creatively.
Yeah.
I think I've spent a lot of time doing that. I mean, look at DirectAI when we started our hosting and domain names business. We eventually became the only company from India that hadn't deployed a significant amount of capital, that was based in Asia, that became fourth largest in the world, competing with some of the global giants with much higher capital than us.
Correct.
So, and how did we manage to do that? Well, we decided early on that because our core competence is tech, we don't know much about these markets, we're going to establish and create the world's best reseller platform that enables us to leverage thousands of companies around the world who will actually then pool in their capital and their wherewithal
with this process of marketing. Yeah.
That's the creative approach that we took to get to that stage, right? Similarly, if I look at, you know, let's say with Flock and Zeta. With Zeta, we, you know, we now have 2 million people who use our employee benefits product and wallet. We've achieved that through partnerships. In fact, it's a revenue stream without any kind of cash backs or cash burn. To acquire the same kind of quality of users, I mean, these are all, you know, salary, tax-paying employees, extremely high purchasing power in companies like Accenture, Amazon, IBM, Wipro. Many large B2C companies will probably spend hundreds of millions of dollars to acquire that kind of base, and we've actually made it a revenue opportunity for us. Right? So I've always believed there are creative ways to get through. In fact, I talk about this, that sometimes overfunding can actually result in substituting creativity with cash.
Absolutely.
You actually have limited capital, you're forced to think creatively. So I think it's a function of that. I must admit that on the other side, there are B2C businesses who, by the very nature of what they're trying to do in a country or by virtue of competition, because there's so much funding in the market, have no choice but to burn capital to acquire customers. I probably have consciously stayed away from some of those kinds of businesses where, unfortunately, the status quo is that there is a lot of capital burn taking place. And so you might be able to apply creativity, but you won't be able to make a significant dent.
Thank you for listening, and you can find the transcribed version of this podcast on matrixpartners.in. You can also follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn for more updates.